Well, as time went on, after the asbestos abatement occurred, we stopped getting any responses from the builder. And that silence became, okay, there's no one ever on the job site. We can't find anyone on the job site. Oh, this phone number has now been shut off. His subcontractors haven't been paid.
Hello, fellow risk takers, and welcome to my worst investment ever. Stories of loss to keep you winning. In our community, we know that to win in investing, you must take risk, but to win big, you've got to reduce it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm on a mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives. And I want to thank my listeners from Denver, Colorado for joining us today. So, fellow risk takers, this is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stotz, and I'm here with featured guest, Athena Brownson. Athena, are you ready to join the mission?
I could not be more ready. I was born ready. Let's do this, Andrew.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear your story, and you've got some interesting journeys that you've been in life. So I'm going to just introduce you to the audience. So Athena is a Denver realtor, investor, developer, and former professional skier, whose resilience through chronic illness fuels her refined, strategic, and client-focused approach to real estate. Athena, take a minute and tell us about the unique value that you are bringing to this wonderful world.
You know, I think I've lived many lives at this point, as you just stated in this beautiful intro. And the element that is encompassed by all of the things I've experienced is that I am centered around human relationship. I run my business from a very relational standpoint, and I bring the passion, drive, accountability, and authenticity that I learned as a professional athlete and as someone fighting with chronic illness to my business. You know, we're living in a day and age where AI is kind of taking over. But one thing that AI cannot take over, hopefully, is the human connection. And that is something I excel at in a transaction that is life-changing for people. And it is able to bring people long-term financial freedom. So I take a lot of pride in being able to do that.
That's exciting. And when I think about it, the human connection is critical for sure. But sometimes we go to, let's say, whether it's a realtor or whoever it is, we go to them because they're hard science. They got data, you know, they help us, you know, in that way. But what is it that they, why do people go to you? What is it that they get from you, the feeling or the outcomes that they get that they're not going to get somewhere else?
Absolutely. So whether you're looking for, say, a $200,000 condo or a $10 million home, my team and I provide red carpet, white glove service to everyone. You're going to be listened to. You're going to have a trusted advisor, not just someone that's interested in getting a transaction done, but you're going to have a trusted advisor that's helping you to assess what the best possible investment for your future is. And that could mean looking at a property that you think might be a great fit and me pointing out, hey, these are some fatal flaws that are going to really affect the value of how the property is going to increase over time. And I think we really need to rediscuss if this is a good option for you. So you're going to get authenticity while at the same time getting the best possible client experience, which really comes down to giving great communication and listening to your client. It really comes down to listening. And it's funny how hard that is for many people.
Yeah, well, that's the good thing about being a podcast host is you got to shut up.
Amen.
Which is so hard sometimes.
Absolutely. I struggle myself.
Just out of curiosity, what's happening? You know, there's so many different factors going on in real estate these days. Like, you know, you had COVID and the damage that that did to commercial real estate. You had interest rates shooting back up, you know, a couple of years ago and remaining high. Now you've got potential, you know, migrants or reverse migration or whatever. I don't know all the different factors that are going on, but what's happening in the Denver market these days.
I would start by saying it is a roller coaster and the direction changes almost daily. But what we saw, you know, actually COVID times were probably one of the most booming markets that Denver's seen in quite a while. Now, Denver overall has one of the fastest appreciating markets in the country until about a year and a half ago. So when interest rates decided to go, you know, about to 7%, you know, a little over 7%, our market came to almost a complete halt, except for the ultra-luxury market. So properties over $5 million were still selling because mainly they were being bought and, you know, traded with cash. So we didn't see a huge differentiation there. But the rest of the market came to a complete halt. Properties that were typically sitting on the market for about 2 days started sitting on the market for over 100 days. The amount of sellers that wanted to sell their home, you know, the people that were selling because they had to. So the inventory was a little bit sparse and buyers were gun shy. Just in the last 2.5 weeks, as the new year has begun, I've seen a very strong increase in buyer activity, which is hopeful considering all of the things going on in the world and in our country at the moment. You know, it's a very uncertain time, I feel, and that uncertainty translates into real estate very directly. But we do have promises of, you know, continuing to gradually decrease interest rates over the next every 90 days. We also hear some radical statements about interest rates going down significantly all at once, and we'll see what happens there. Maybe the 50-year mortgage, but I don't want to speculate. So you know what? I have hope that it's going to be a strong year in the world of real estate, but the last two have been the most difficult in my 11 and a half years by far.
And one of the other things that I hear about a lot is the idea of, you know, a lack of inventory in the U.S. residential market, particularly. And I know that that was a big factor, you know, 3 to 5 years ago. And, you know, normally rising prices attracts more construction and you get, you know, more build out. And I'm just curious, like, what's the state? I haven't even heard about it for a long time. And I'm just curious, has there been an addition to inventories or has that never really kept pace or got to where it needs to be?
That's an excellent question. So yes, the inventory that we have seen on the market in the last year and a half, while there has been a slight increase in inventory, the quality of inventory has been really low, to be honest with you. Mm. And with that being said, you know, I work very closely with a commercial lender who gives me a lot of insight into what they're lending on in terms of commercial new housing projects. Mm. Over the last 2.5 years, it came to a complete halt. There was absolutely no developers that wanted to start new projects and build new inventory. And we felt it and we're feeling it currently. But I sat down with him about 2 weeks ago and I was so excited, elated, because he said that they have closed more loans for big new construction projects in the last 3 months than they did in the last 2 years combined. So I foresee that come, you know, these builders are going up in 6-8 months, you're seeing their finish time. So I think 6 months from now, we're going to be seeing an influx of new construction that is going to help support our market. And a lot of times new construction comes with really great loan packages that they've partnered with a lender. They're able to then offer a lower interest rate because that lender is buying down huge blocks of mortgage-backed securities. And then the consumer is able to get, say, a 4 or 5% interest rate as opposed to a 6% interest rate. So it actually can really help the consumer as well. So I'm excited to see new construction thrive again because it has been very dry for the past couple of years.
And my one last question is that because I lived in Thailand when I grew up, I didn't really think that much about buying property. But I did, you know, at one point think, oh, maybe I'll buy a condo. And so I saw one coming up near my place that was near a park and I liked it. So I thought, I'll buy that. And I bought one of those and they were building it. And once it was constructed, I kind of realized pretty quickly that I'm probably not going to live there because it's a little bit smaller than where I was living at the time. So And then I rented it, and then eventually I sold it. And I sold it for probably, you know, a little bit more than what I bought it for. And then I just realized the condo in Bangkok, it's not really a great investment because despite the fact that it's a booming, you know, city over the years and there's a lot of people in it, you just have so much great new supply coming on all the time. And it's like depresses the final resale. And I think that's where condos in a more developed market, like in the US or let's say a US city, there's just not this huge level of new, fancy, amazing supply coming on that just pushes down. And so my question to you is, what is the likelihood that if somebody buys a condo in Denver, and let's say they hold it for, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years, and then they sell it, what's the likelihood that they would sell it at a price higher than what they bought it for?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And it's something that comes up quite often that I have to discuss with clients because condos, especially in large metropolitan cities, like you said, are the slowest appreciating real estate investment that you can make. And it used to be that there was more flexibility with HOAs that people could short-term rent the properties, but almost every HOA makes it pretty much impossible to short-term a condo right now. So if you're going to be renting it out with condo rate interest rates being higher than the typical residential conventional loan, they're usually about 0.5% to 1% higher. You might be breaking even in Denver. And when you look at that part of the investment, combined with the fact that it is the slowest appreciating asset in real estate, and most condos that I see have been sitting on the market for over 200 days because there's a huge number of them, like you said, unless it's the newest, greatest thing, which is not really happening very quickly here. We're seeing a lot more apartment buildings going up due to construction defects laws. You're not looking at a great amount of appreciation. However, I do believe if you're buying and holding for 10, 15 years, you will absolutely see the ability to make some profit after paying out commissions and paying, you know, title insurance fees and everything like that. So yes, but is it going to be equivalent to if you put that money into even a townhome or a single family home? Absolutely not.
Well, that's a great discussion and updates me at least and the audience on what's going on in real estate. So now it's time to share your worst investment ever. And since no one goes into their worst investment thinking it will be, tell us a bit about the circumstances leading up to it and then tell us your story.
Oh, did I think that it was going to be the worst investment ever? You know, I think everyone gets a little bit trigger shy to tell these stories. But when I look back, I am a firm believer that we learn the greatest lessons in life through falling on our face and by listening to podcasts like yours, where we're learning about where other people fell on their face. And boy, did I fall on my face. So, and you know what? I'll lead up to that with I had a really amazing, experienced team around me that was helping me make decisions that also fell on their face. So it wasn't just a newbie. So my father was a residential real estate developer for the last 45 years. He built out most of the ski town Breckenridge in Colorado. He did a lot of high-end luxury, probably developed over 100 luxury properties in his time. And it was finally time to get him down to Denver and start developing with me. Well, on our first project, you know, we partnered up. I had saved up a good amount of money for a very long time that it took me to do so. And when we were going to hire the builder for the property that we wanted to build, you know, I already owned the lot. It was a property that I bought and was renting out. So we already had the land. And when I started talking to the builder, it was someone that I knew for over 3 years. It was a dear friend's business partner in another business. And my father, his team, and I sat down with these builders multiple times. And, you know, my dad is extremely experienced in knowing exactly what questions to ask. I'm sitting there like taking notes on everything he's saying, just trying to learn as much as I can about his process and how to vet the right person. Well, all of those interviews, all of those questions that we asked, I had only spoken to a a couple of people that had worked with this builder, and I'd walked one of their projects. I was really impressed with it. But when we went to sign a contract with them, which we were so excited about, I really trusted these people. We put down about $130,000, which was to get the project off the ground, you know, scrape the current property, do asbestos abatement, start the foundation excavation process. So it was a good chunk of money that I had been saving up for a very, very long time. Now I start going to the property and notice that not much has happened except for a big blue fence went around it. And over time, you know, I keep driving by it and I'm asking the builder, okay, when are things going to start? Well, we got into the asbestos abatement phase. So I got really excited that I saw some forward movement. We're starting to make a little bit of progress with the city. Although now in hindsight, I realized that it was going very, very slow and that probably should have been a red flag. But I still had complete faith. I believed these guys were going to do such a good job for us. And so did my father, you know, again, with 45 years of experience. Well, as time went on, after the asbestos abatement occurred, we stopped getting any responses from the builder. And that silence became, okay, there's no one ever on the job site. We can't find anyone on the job site. Oh, this phone number has now been shut off. His subcontractors haven't been paid that were hired on our job. You know, the people that did the asbestos abatement and started the excavation had not been paid and were coming to us saying, you know, what's going on? We can't get a hold of this guy. Well, he unfortunately ran with the 100 and, you know, there's probably 110 left after what he did. And he ran. And I found out later on that I was one of about 8 people that that happened to with this particular builder. And unfortunately, being in the real estate industry, you know, I like to think that I know what's going on. I have my pulse on the business. I know a lot of builders. I know their reputations. But this is something that happens far too often in this industry. And you can come in with a huge amount of experience and it can still happen. So I honestly can't believe to this day that this is something that is still an ongoing investigation, actually.
When you make the payment, you're making the payment to his company or to him?
Correct. To his company and his proprietary member, or not member, owner of the company.
Right. Sole
proprietor. But yeah. Yes, sole proprietor. So we were making payments to his construction company and it disappeared.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. So how would you summarize the lessons that you learned?
Oh, you know, endless lessons. I think the number one thing, and I've heard this in a lot of the guests that you speak with, is the importance of the due diligence process. And for me, in hindsight, I look at the due diligence process as I should have gotten a list of maybe 10 people that he was currently working with and another list of people that he had finished projects for. And I should have called through all of them and the story of exactly how it went. Because at the same time that this was happening to me, and even a little bit prior, there were people that were also being ripped off. And if I had taken the time to make phone calls to a greater number of people and not just people within my network, I would have found out that there was something not right about the way that they were doing business. And I really believe that's the due diligence process. I would have walked their projects. I would have grilled them on exactly how their line items were looking and how what costs they were accruing, what work had actually been done.
And you mentioned mentioned that there was a connection between a friend or something like that. So
yeah,
would you normally have done the due diligence, or were you green and thinking that?
I was green.
Yeah.
Okay. I was so green. And that very much clouded my, but I also think one of my, you know, I'm a very trusting person. I grew up in a small community. I do business with really wonderful people. Mm. And I think I was a little bit naive, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I didn't think people would do that. And that was my bad.
There's a few things I want to share from that story. And the first one, you said trusting, right? Right then it just reminded me, I have a friend of mine that was really, I really admired his accomplishments, particularly when I was younger and I came to Thailand and I saw he had a factory, he had a good business. He was a really smart guy. He had good amount of money and all that. And he sold his business and, you know, over time moved to Australia and he lost all of his money. And now he's, you know, 78 in Australia or so. And his life is very hard right now. And we talk, and I was just, you know, asking him the other day, we were having a call and I said, let's go through and see why did it happen?
Yeah.
And we went through it and he trusted people with his money.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of people they trusted with his money that lived up to that trust. But, you know, there was 3 to 5 that just took it.
Heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking and you can't earn it back at that time. And So that's the first thing I wanted to share that I've heard you use the word trust. The second one is that when I was young, I bought a motorcycle. I was 16 or 18 or something like that. And what happened? I sold that motorcycle to another guy that I went to high school with. I wasn't close with him, and he gave me a check and I said, we're going to meet at the bank. And I'm going to give that check to the bank. They're going to cash it. And I'm going to take the cash. It was $700 at the time. Was a lot of money for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to then sign over, you know, the title. And so we did that. And I felt pretty proud that, you know, I was like, I want cash in my hand.
Yeah.
And like the next day, the bank called me and said, you need to bring back that cash. And I was like, wait, what? You can do that? And
like, they said, how? Yes.
They're like, we have 3 days that, you know, he has stopped the payment of the check. And you need to bring the money back. So I went back to the bank, gave him $700. I went to his house and said, give me my motorcycle back. And he said, no.
Did you beat him up?
That thought crossed my mind. But, you know, I'm a peaceful,
it's better to
loving
just...
guy.
Exactly.
But I took him to court. And I didn't know what else to do. I thought, okay, you know, America, you know, you're going to take someone to court. They do that. So I took him to court, which was, you know, I defended myself, you know, because I didn't know anything. I'm not going to spend money on this. So, and I remember the night before his father asked to meet me and said, I'll pay you right now. And then we'll get this over. I thought, no, I'm already gone to court. Let's do it. And
principle.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, I won and I still had to collect the money. You know, just because you win in court,
yeah,
you have to collect the money, you know, so
they're not going to collect it for you, unfortunately.
So it just was a big lesson of understanding about receiving and giving money and all of that. And, you know, you get some protections through bank for sure, but also you get some protection for pure cash to say, hey, I want to buy this computer from you secondhand. And I say, okay, it's $500. And then, okay, you pay me. We made a deal. That's it. Done. You can't recall that. So it just made me think about those types of things. So, yeah.
And it's so, you know, I think right now the amount of scammers and the amount of, you know, something very similar to what happened to your friend actually happened to my mother recently, not on that big of a scale by any means. But, you know, it was so convincing. And in a million years, it's not something any of us would have picked up on. So I think the importance of questioning everything now is really critical. And unfortunately, we can't just trust everyone. We need to assume the worst. And then hopefully they can prove to us that the best is actually the outcome, but not the other way around.
Yeah. In fact, I was thinking about it as you were talking. It's like maybe the lesson is, you know, you just got to hold your money.
Right.
Like it's your life energy, which is exactly what the book Your Money or Your Life is about, which is a great personal finance book. And that book basically says you look at money like it's, you know, a piece of paper. No, it is your life energy that has been converted into a piece of paper. And you would never give away your life energy just walking down the street, you know. But here, because it's been converted to paper, you think about it differently. So
That's a beautiful analogy, really.
It's in fact, great book. It's called...
I'm going to have to read that. Thank you.
Your Money or Your Life. And I'll put it in the show notes also. I'll send you a link, but it's from Vicky Robin and Joe Dominguez, which was written a while ago and it's been updated, but it really shifts, you know, your thinking on money. So
I would love to read that. Thank you.
As you can see, I've read more than 3,000 books in my life, and I just constantly looking at books and reading. So now basically,
you might be one of my favorite people. That is so cool.
just read. Yep. Now, based on what you learned from this story and what you continue to learn, what one action, let's go back in time. Yep. What one action would you recommend our listeners take to avoid suffering the same fate?
You know, I grew up also in the world of lumber yards. My dad sold lumber, and they always said, measure twice, cut once. And that, to me, is a statement for everything we do. It's double, triple check, do everything that you possibly can to gain knowledge, and then find a mentor if you can. You know, I think that I'm a firm believer in mentorship and coaching, probably from my background in skiing. But I believe that we, you know, we have blind spots that we're not necessarily able to see on our own. And a simple conversation with someone that we know, like, and trust, you know, is invaluable, because they can point out to us the blind spots that maybe our excitement is, you know, what. In big investments, we have a lot of excitement. There's a lot of emotion going. And even if you want to make a decision without emotion, it can be very difficult to do so. So having a trusted advisor that you can go to, no matter if you're, you know, the CEO of a Fortune 500 company or you're a realtor in Denver, I think it's pivotal to have people in your life that can help you see your blind spots and that are not afraid to speak up and tell you what those are.
Yeah, and that conversation's got to not be in search of confirmation. It has to be,
what is wrong here?
Yeah, and then you got to be quiet and listen. All right, so what's a resource that you'd recommend for our listeners?
A resource that I would recommend for your listeners is, again, mentorship and coaching. I do a little bit of coaching on my Instagram. I'd give real estate tips and tricks all the time. It's at Athena Brownson Realtor. But everything that I know, I have learned from someone who knows it even better than I do, and that I have absorbed like a sponge. And we have such an access to information these days. So whether, you know, it's self-taught, because you're on masterclass or you're listening to amazing podcasts like this, we have so many different ways to learn these days that it doesn't necessarily have to be mentoring and coaching, but I think some sort of educational resource that you're constantly feeding yourself with so you can stay relevant and stay aware and also have community and accountability. I mean, I think that's really an important part too. And that's why I gravitate towards mentorship and coaching, although I never do not have a podcast on in the background of everything I'm doing. So,
yeah. And, you know, get help.
Yeah. Ask for help.
I did a little, around COVID time, I saw that young people weren't getting jobs at university. So I thought, okay. I can give them internships. And at one point, I had 100 interns.
Andrew, holy cow.
And it was after COVID, but around that time. And I got some of the smartest, you know, interesting young kids. And they would come work with me.
That is so neat.
And
what a gift. What a gift you gave those kids. Seriously.
Yeah. And it's just like, the idea of coaching and getting help. What I did is I asked the students, because I, you know, have this big group of students. I said, go on your LinkedIn, find 5 people that match this description, you know, let's say a human resource manager or whatever, and ask them, would you be willing to answer these 3 questions, you know, just in reply? But when you do, half of you guys just, you know, introduce yourself normally, and other half say, I'm a student. Would you help me with this?
Oh.
And the response was huge for the ones that said, I'm a student. And it really helped me to first tell my students in other areas, like, ask for help. People want to help.
They do.
And if you have the advantage of saying, this is a project, this is something I'm working on for my MBA, this is something I'm working on research, you know, give them a good reason like that, and people want to help.
They do. It actually is an act of service, and people do enjoy serving others at the very core. So yeah, that's beautiful. That was
really
hearing
cool
that.
Being there to watch the two cohorts getting their answers and their replies live. I was like, this is a great neat experiment.
Yeah,
exactly. So,
all
right,
cool.
last question. What is your number one goal for the next 12 months?
Oh, I'm so excited about everything right now. So my number one goal is to continue building a really trusted referral network that's going to allow me to serve more clients in building long-term wealth through real estate, whether they're big-time investors or they're buying their first home and just need help making a really wise decision so that they're gaining equity and the appreciation is there so that we can then roll them into something else that's another investment. So it's really to continue building really deep, genuine, authentic relationships with people and continue growing my team as well. You know, I work with just 4 at the moment, people that are on my team, and they're the most incredible humans that anyone could ever dream to work with. And I'd love to continue to be able to mentor younger agents and help them get their feet under them in the business. Because if I didn't have the mentor that I did when I got started, I followed every move he made for the first year of my career, I wouldn't know anything like I do now. So my goal is to be able to do the same.
Awesome. Well, listeners, there you have it. Another story of loss to keep you winning. Remember, I'm on a mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives. And as we conclude, Athena, I want to thank you again for joining this mission. And on behalf of Ace Dots Academy, I hereby award you alumni status for turning your worst investment ever into your best teaching moment. Do you have any parting words for the audience?
I would say, first, thank you for having me, and don't make rushed decisions. Take your time and know that the right thing is going to come into place at the right time.
Wonderful. And that's a wrap on another great story to help us create, grow, and protect our wealth. Fellow risk takers, let's celebrate that today we added one more person to our mission to help 1 million people reduce risk in their lives. This is your worst podcast host, Andrew Stott Singh. I'll see you on the upside.